So when you have that bigger interest, that's like in war. Some people are going to die fighting a war, even if the war is a just cause. So what you look at was, how did the death occur? Was it senseless? Some fools playing with a hand grenade and blew themselves up, or they were trying to take out a machine gun emplacement and got done in.
I understand that, but it's been statistically proven that we get harsher.
Can you hear me?
Wait. Dr. Brian, I'd like to give you a proper introduction.
Let's have a good introduction.
So Dr. Cheyenne Bryant, I got this off the website, so forgive me if this isn't up to date, but our guest today, Dr. Cheyenne Bryant, is a psychology expert, renowned life coach, the president of NAACP Branch 1069, founder of Dr. Bryant Institute, founder of Dr. Bryant Foundation nonprofit, author of the award-winning Reader's Favorite Five-Star Book, Mental Detox, speaker, community activist, and brand ambassador. So welcome, Dr. Cheyenne Bryant. I know that we're going to talk about your role on Teen Mom and the family reunion, but would you like to address statistics, psychology, what
resume?
We should share with?
May
yes,
I add
sir.
Something more to her
I'm
resume?
Actually just going to fall
she
back and just give you guys a chance to talk.
Dr. Bryant, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong, doctor, also sets up the psychology profiles for the Los Angeles County Unified School District when they're having racial problems in the school. I think you're now with Los Angeles Police Department as a consultant to deal with psychological evaluations and relative to fitness to either be a cop or continue as a cop for officers who are involved in various things. And weren't you basically in charge of the suicide hotline for Long Beach and stuff like that? Yes. Okay.
You're along the right line.
Yeah.
Yes. I do work side by our LAPD chief and their training department on just different things such as cultural competence and training systemically that may or may not be effective, the things that are effective, keeping it, how to modify it, how to change it. And so we have some exciting stuff coming up in the spring with our LAPD, our law enforcement. There's a couple of things you said that I wanted to touch on. You mentioned the training and how they set up these assimilation trainings that is supposed to prepare them for real life events. There's a phrase that I say, I got from Abraham Hicks, words don't teach, experience does. And that's something that I've been discussing with the LAPD head of the training department, that the training that they're doing, it's not experience, it is training. So when you are on the street and you're pulling over a car full of folks that you do not know, you have no cultural competence about, you don't understand where they come from, what they've been through, you don't understand their trauma, what trauma looks like on them, what trauma shows up for them, and what triggers them, that's a whole different ballgame than when you're in assimilation or looking at videos that show you different black and brown people experiencing certain things and telling them the protocol as to how you pull them over and what that looks like. A few things happen when an officer who happens to not be minority, let's just go a little more reality, white Caucasian officer, pulls over someone who is of color, there's a few things that happen. There is an approved intimidation factor that comes in. There is a white privilege or superiority factor that can often come into play. And what that does is it shifts the entire dynamic of authority from pulling someone over to provide community policing guidance or to enforce the law to now being a higher authority that says you do what I tell you to do. You ask no questions as though I am a parent to you, no longer now a law enforcement who's here to enforce the law, but also provide guidance and educate you on what I do know as an officer and what you do not know. Because, again, if I'm the trained officer and you're a civilian, that means I already have information and resources that you need to know, whether I write you a ticket, put you in handcuffs or not. My job is to provide that information to you while I enforce the law so that we can at some point get you to be a citizen, abiding citizen, that can be a value, right, to the community. Another thing you said, Judge, that is, I think that is so important, is you mentioned that oftentimes society doesn't put much emphasis or investment into the you know, black murders on behalf of the law enforcement or authorities because they don't see this person as being a person who is of any value in society upon their demise. So what they're doing is, again, this goes back to the slavery days, they're looking at the person and say, listen, if you are black or you are brown and you don't contribute to the community or society, it's almost like they're happy that they were able to rid them of the headache or rid them of the burden or rid them of the crimes that they're committing, which, again, all of those aforementioned, crimes, burdens, all those are actions. Yes, those are actions and behaviors that are being exhibited by the person, i.e. the human being. But in psychology, we have a thing of saying you treat the symptom, not the person, and you treat the behavior, not the person, meaning the person is the one, obviously, who is committing or exhibiting the behavior. But when we're enforcing the laws or when we are looking at a person no longer being an asset to society, we have to look at their behavior being the piece that doesn't bring value. It's not the human being themselves. It is extremely challenging for people to separate the two because, to be transparent, when I first got into the field 13 years ago, I thought, excuse my language, that's bullshit. How do you separate a person from their actions? The person, the actions, to me, were the same thing. No, they're not. Because when a person is triggered or put in a certain environment, you get a different behavior or action based on where you place them and how they're triggered, which means that a black man or brown man or woman will behave, act, or be triggered differently depending on who pulls them over. And let me go a little further. The part that makes it very interesting and probably also sad is that it's not just Caucasian folks who are looking at some of these, you know, minority who are victims of crimes on behalf of law enforcement as being no value to society. You got a lot of minorities who also see it that way. You got a lot of, you know, black folks who see it as, hey, well, this person's a criminal. They're not doing anything but committing black-on-black crimes. They're not doing anything but running in stores with a ski mask on and doing smash and grabs or causing more havoc for our community and hiring the crime rate and lowering the public safety rate. So there is no value. You know, well, thank God they were able to get them off the street before they hit my house or before that crime or that behavior hit my backyard or before my child has to walk to school and be a victim to this person. So, you know, I often like to be able to be very real about statistics or about race and racial things. White supremacy does exist. White privilege is extremely, you know, existent and happens. However, you know, not every white person is prejudiced, like not every black person is poor. And if we got to talk real, you have a lot of folks who look like us, and look like us means me, I'm a black woman, who also exhibit systemic behaviors that indirectly, subconsciously go against our black agenda. So in the forefront, you have to look at things for what they are presenting and who they are, and not just this person's white, this person's black, and because they were a white officer who showed up in this way, then it's racism. It's not always like that. There are some protocols that are not condoning any murder at the hands of officers on anybody minority, but there's a mix between community education and police systemic training being modified that both need to be addressed. We cannot just train and modify training with officers, regardless of what their race is, and then have them go on the street and show up in a more passive way with criminals, regardless of the race of the criminal. If my home was getting broken into and somebody was getting ready to shoot or kill a child in my home, I would not want a passive officer coming in my house, regardless of the race, saying, hey, excuse me, you know, can you put the gun down? My first thing would be, why aren't you shooting this man, taking him out so that we are safe because we are the victims in here being victimized? And so, again, I think the optics of things need to be further looked into, deeper than just what was the race of the person getting pulled over, victimized, arrested, and what is the race of the officer behind the action of it. I think we have to go deeper because, like George Floyd, murder, we get that. Hands down murder. We totally understand that, get that. But there's some incidents where, for example, here in Los Angeles, our DA happened to say, listen, you know, if you do not create a felony charge during the pandemic, you will not get arrested. And if we do happen to arrest you, we book you, let you out in an hour, and you won't have a court date for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months. What does that mean? That means that our crime rate went through the roof. LAPD called it a slight rise in crime rate. Dr. Bryant, president of NAACP, called it a crime crisis. Because when you have folks who are putting on ski masks, doing smash and grabs, running in different businesses and homes and houses, okay, using AK-47 illegal ghost firearms to murder and kill people in their homes, and that's the only way that they will go to jail is if they commit a murder, they're able to rob and steal from Nordstrom's and corporations and small businesses in homes. And if they do not murder you, but they harm you, and they take what you have worked hard for your whole life, create psychological damage and trauma that this person can get out the next day, unless you're going to give me a firearm and tell me that I can let off every round and I will be guaranteed not to go to jail if someone comes in my house, that is horrible. That is horrible and terrifying for any community. So we have to have law enforced. Judge, really quick, I'm wrapping up. We have to have law enforced. While we're not condoning.
Take your time.
We got to have law enforced, but not condoning murders or mistreatment of our black and brown folks, because it's a human right to be treated right and for laws to be enforced, but not to be abused at the hands of law enforcement. But we still have to stand up as black folks and say, if you commit a crime, it's right that you do the crime. If you're running in people's homes and you're robbing and stealing and murdering, then listen, you are setting yourself up for the possibility of running out of that house with a pistol and possibly not being able to make it to the jail cell alive. We're not condoning mistreatment, but damn it, you can't condone just because a person looks like you that it's okay for them to run into a home, a bank with elderly people, you know, like they did in Los Angeles. They killed an 81-year-old black woman in her home with a shotgun, a 12-gauge shotgun. That's not okay. That is not okay. And the only way the man got caught is because he shot himself in the foot with his shotgun. He was already on house number 3 when he got caught. Because of the passive laws, which I believe RDA was attempting to make up for all of his stop and frisk and redlining he was doing when he was DA up north. So then you come into a new community, want to make up for what you believe was a mistake, and now you have majority of our black men in prison or dead because now they have the green light to commit crime. But hold on. But in Los Angeles or in California, we as homeowners, we as citizens don't have the green light to protect ourselves because we can't bear arms. So, Judge, you and I had this conversation before. You said, anytime someone cannot protect themselves, then the predator will always smell weakness. So if I can't protect myself and the criminal or the predator knows that, that person already has a green light to take full advantage of me. So again, it's much deeper. It's very systemic, and we have a lot of people who are minority who unknowingly are pushing the white supremacist agenda and not the human rights agenda. And then we have a lot of people who are Caucasian who are pushing the black equity equality agenda, who we are pinning them into one whole group as white people and saying, then you're not on our side and you're bad too. That's why it has to be something that's deeper than just at the optics and the eye level. And that's why I am very honored and grateful to be able to work systemically with our LAPD, with our law enforcement, enforcement officers in Los Angeles, because it comes systemically from the conversations at the table and someone that doesn't happen to look black or brown or color being at the table to say, hold on, let me give you a culture competent perspective. Let me explain to you that trauma looks different on people like me, because we come from traumatized communities. And so when you pull us over and you say this in this tone, you're damn right we're triggered. And when we're triggered, it also looks like it. And it doesn't mean that we are a threat. If you understand the people you're serving, you may be able to save the people you're serving and do yourself a service of really providing what our tax dollars pay for, community policing, enforce the law, and practice and honor human rights. Because that's what it boils down to at the end of the day. And we have to make sure systemically that the black officers are protected and that they are psychologically being treated and facilitated and supported, because what's worse than looking at George Floyd on your TV screen as an officer who's black and male and having to process that someone that looked like me just got murdered at the hands of somebody that looks like me and in the same uniform that I wear? You're talking about an internal struggle, but I got to put my uniform on the next day and go to work, and I got to be on this side. And so do I feel like I'm selling out my community? Because this is my career. This is how I feed my family. But I have an opinion, but I can't have a voice, because if I voice this in the locker room or systemically, how will I be treated when I have to go to work and my family needs health care, my family needs to eat? So there's so many different moving parts that need to be collectively looked at and shift, modified. But it can't happen until we get internal and say, like I am now, you know, working on doing, talking to the Black Officer Association. I want to know what they need to hear, but I have to create a safe environment where they will not be pinged, they will not be threatened by saying what their needs are as black officers who are wearing the uniform of the men who happen to be creating the crime of the men or on the men who look like them as well, right? Let's process that internal struggle. Because if we don't, what happens is we get an angry black man who's in an officer uniform who's on the street, and he's no different than the white guy who cannot process all of what he's going through and his issues, and he's not able to debrief, and now you have a gap between law enforcement and community when at the peak of it all, they're supposed to be the same. They're supposed to be the same. And so there's a lot of moving parts that it takes more than just my little self to do, but I'm very grateful that I've been able to, you know, spearhead or take the lead in having this conversation and shaking the boat and pushing the throttle and not being afraid of the backlash and not being afraid of them saying no or we don't understand or, you know, we need more dialogue and saying I'm tired of having dialogue and I'm tired of having the conversation. We've been having this conversation for too long. We need actions. We need to be completely involved. And the only way you get culture competence, because words don't teach, experience does, is to have someone who has the culture there to have that conversation with you to give you the experience of what it looks like on me when I'm expressing myself or what it looks like on a black male who grew up in a gang territory community. And so when he hears your sirens, he triggers.
Doc, let me ask you something right there. Put a pin in that. We'll come right back to you. Look, you talked about the cultural competence, and you talk about our people are in a constant state of anger because of what's going on. I have been thinking for the last few years that there is a thing about human communications that we don't take into account. They say that when humans are face-to-face, only 15% of what they're saying consists of the words. 35% is the tone, and 50% is the body language. So that makes it work out that 85% of what happens sometimes when you have an interracial stranger situation, white and black or whatever it may be, Hispanic black or Hispanic white, if one is not familiar with the other's culture and has not gotten used to it, if you're dealing with somebody black, you are going to pick up a lot of innate anger that's going to be conveyed in the body language and in the tone that is ordinary and typical of communications that that person gives. You are in a tense situation to begin with, and what ought to be happening is both sides doing things that would diffuse the tension, but the black guy is sending out signals that are hostile in the reaction that the white person is having. If the white person had familiarity with what the black person is saying, he wouldn't take it as hostile. So when the white person reacts subconsciously to the hostility, the black person starts reacting subconsciously to the hostility, and I've been there watching it as it goes down, as it ramps up. And what happens is you get the news media, mainstream media, doing what I just got through hearing them do with this for their own commercial purposes to boost commercial advertisement and ratings. They ramp it up even more. So what happens is this system, this society, is on a rampage to make the people that depend upon them for their information to be more ignorant about the other side, to be more off into the poisonous grip of extreme emotions rather than rationality, logic, and reason. And we have just set ourselves on course for an absolute disaster. The other thing is,
go ahead.
The system is trying to emasculate the public. And part of the emasculation
Before you go on, let me make one small comment about that, because then I probably want to make a comment about what you're going to say now. I love what you said about the dynamic of how they paint or create that narrative so that they can create an optic for those watching the media and everyone else. My main question has always been, and it's like a rhetorical kind of sarcastic question, who's the trained facilitator here? Because me as a doctor, I'm trained. Right? So wait, so when one of my clients acts up in maybe one of their bipolar or schizoaffective or paranoid schizoaffective disorders, they start to react in those ways or they're depressed, whatever that looks like. My job as the trained doctor facilitator is to be able to regulate my emotions because I'm trained. So the expectation of me showing up in what is quote unquote the right way is much higher than it would be for my client who's sitting in my chair saying I'm depressed, I'm dark, I'm grieving, and I'm having an emotional roller coaster experience, can't regulate myself. I am not there to match their emotional state. I'm there to facilitate, I'm there to guide, and I'm there to show up as the professional trained facilitator. Same thing if we're talking about law enforcement. You are trained to be able to, or you should be, handle high intense situations. So when you pull over somebody who cannot emotionally regulate themselves or their trauma is being triggered, if you match their emotional state, you to me do not belong on the streets in that car pulling anybody over. Because now one or two things are happening. Either the training is full of shit or you have an issue personally means you're not respecting the protocol of how you were trained, and either way, you got to go. Because you don't need to be pulling somebody over if you don't understand your position and you don't understand how regulated you have to be. And that's why, Judge, in our last show, I said it's 100% mandatory, it should be, that every officer has a debriefing once a week therapy session because he has to be able to debrief all of what he's suppressing. You can't suppress all that and regulate all your emotions every day of your life and don't think you won't be an atomic bomb. And the next time you're ready to explode, you pull over a black guy who just tells you, you know, what did I do? And you say, don't ask me a question. You pull out your pistol. Now this man is dead, but he's dead because all the other 150 interactions you've had when you haven't had a chance to debrief. This is why it is, again, it's the organization of the law enforcement who is at fault. Because you know your guys are out there under pressure, seeing crimes, murder, rape victims, having to suppress and be professionals, and regulate their emotions every day of their life. And don't mention if they got to go home and be a husband and wife or a kid, they have to regulate there too. And you're putting them back on the street and you don't have a psychologist to see and sit with them every day to debrief them and treat your officers. You need to be pinged every time an officer kills a black man and goes to jail. The organization needs to have consequences as well. That's why it continues to happen. You're putting them out there knowing that they're not able to function, Judge. If I agree with you. And I'm borderline and I don't take my medication, Judge, and you and I have a conversation and I flip out on you and you are responsible for administering me my medicine, it's your fault just as much as it's my fault. Because you were made my caretaker. You were made my conservator. You were made responsible for me. So when I flip my wig on you, don't say take her, take us both. Because you're just as responsible as I am. That's how the organization is with their officers. Because the officers only have so much say-so. They're focused on feeding their family and making sure they have health care. The organization should be focused on how in the heck are we going to get our boys and girls on this street so that they can provide community policing, enforce the law, and people end up in prison if they are criminals and not dead and now our officers are in jail because the whole system internally is not treating and providing the right care externally and internally. That's a problem.
I agree with you 100%, Doc. And what I was saying was that we are doing, it's almost like we are consciously trying to make the situation worse because this masculine principle, I'm saying the masculine principle, the yin-yang thing. Okay. We have the emotional side of humanity that's represented, like in Latin languages, as a feminine aspect of humanity. We have the rational, logical aspect of humanity represented as the masculine principle. We've got the right brain, left brain thing. And when you've got the system trying to essentially emasculate the system, well, the society, so that women don't display the masculine principle and they are encouraged to be extra in the feminine principle and the males are encouraged to display the emotive feminine principle, you get a lot of people that think it's all right, have been conditioned to think it's all right, who are practiced and have been getting a lot of practice in being overly emotional, and emotion becomes a justification. So nobody is interested in being rational and logical in a confrontation. And it's poison. And I think this body language is really bad, and even the law embraces that. That's why we are supposed to have diverse juries. So somebody on that jury can identify with the circumstances or at least understand the circumstances of the parties or some of the parties that are going to be in front of that jury. So they say, no, that's not what this guy is saying. You know, I remember there was a jury that had a fight. Literally, the jury got in a fist fight because the language came up of she put him down. Now, what was meant by the person that said that was she got through with him. She didn't want to be bothered with him, and she left him. But some of the white people on the jury from a certain rural environment took, she put him down as though you are getting rid of a sick animal and you euthanize him. They thought she was talking about killing rather than leaving. So you had to have somebody on there to explain that's not what they're talking about. But you see, we have these things where most of what black people say is associated with this glorification of dysfunction that is what the typical child, black or white, gets more so than they get any kind of sense from a sensible parent, certainly no longer from schools because they're not able to do that on threat of somebody suing them, certainly from nowhere. So you get people that are inured to receiving a proper signal and conditioned to interpret a signal in the wrong kind of way. You've got a disaster. And like you said about people busting in to break down the doorways, and if somebody that worked in a mom-and-pop store that is trying to figure out in COVID-19 how they're going to get the mortgage on their home paid and their child's college education needs to be paid for, and somebody comes in there and steals something, and one of them does have a weapon and shoots somebody, then we're going to get a community hollering about his racism. He wasn't doing anything except taking beer. Yeah, but he'd stolen about a few cases worth in the last few months. You see, it's always the justification. I've got a thing right near me from some neighbors. I can't talk on who they are. They live in what was a very upscale black community filled with black professionals, and right down the street from them, some developers got a zoning ordinance variation, and they put in a moderate to low-income Section 8 housing setup, and now this peaceful community has been suffering break-in after break-in, and one of those people who's armed is going to kill one of those people that's breaking in. And I can hear the hell now when somebody gets to talking about it ain't fair, they need to do something because he had no right to shoot my baby. He was only stealing some car or furniture. Right down the street from me, 3/8 of a mile, just 3/8 of a mile. Last week, 2 weeks ago, some teenagers and a young adult male, they were black, had been breaking into places and stealing cars, wrecking the cars, stealing stuff out of people's storage facilities. And they came out one day and they tried to do it down here, and somebody came out and shot one of them. Now everybody is up in an uproar about how wrong it was. And the guy's saying, I had to do what I had to do. And then we had a duplicate of that situation, but this time people are hollering racism because they put this black man in jail. But, yeah, the guy's got 5 violent felony convictions. He was a felon in possession of a handgun. I mean, you see, it's like, what are we doing here that is so inconsistent? Why are we depending upon a 5-second sound bite to make everything concrete and clear when people have to do what you did and what I did, get doctorate degrees, spend a lot of time going through school and a lot of time feet on the ground to get the real world experience to understand this stuff, read book after book, and maybe write a few. But yet you're supposed to be able to convey it to the simpletons in 5 seconds worth of soundbite, and everything is plain. It's all white supremacy, which becomes an excuse to fail, to sit on an ass on a couch, smoke a blunt while playing video games. See, and then you got an excuse for your own failure instead of examining what's wrong with you and doing something about it. Now, they pay money to go see you to get counsel. Me, I was the one that decided whether they went to jail or didn't go to jail. And my job was to give what they call the allocution, the denouncement, the denouement of the ire of the community for the transgression of the law and public decency. But they don't want you to raise your voice because you might hurt someone's feelings. And, of course, when you go to the church now, you get a whole bunch of pulpit pimps who are out there talking about all you got to do is believe. You don't have to behave. And they want to get that money together so they can get a new Mercedes or something, or get the wife a fur coat, or deal with those other kind of boys that run around in the church and pay their bills so they don't turn them in. And nobody talks about do right. We can't talk about right. That's shaming. That's embarrassing. And I don't know about you. I'm not up on the latest psychological aspects of it, but guilt and shame are great controls for human misbehavior and conduct. But anyway, I'll turn it back over to you. You know, I like where you're going with this. People need to hear what you've got to say.
Well, Judge, I have a 2:15 session I have to hop into. But, the main thing is just the optics that are created are not in alignment with a lot of the internal systemic stuff, I'll say, for lack of a better word, that's going on in, our black community, and that's going on in the law enforcement training, and they they don't have those optics. They don't have those insights. And so it is just the media that, you know, folks have to depend on to create a narrative of their own as far as what's racism and who's, you know, prejudiced and what white privilege is and, you know, what that looks like. And it, to me, it creates an even more disparity between two races of people that oftentimes some of the time it's what you said, you know, if a crime is committed, crime is not a color. Crime is breaking the law. And so if you commit a crime, regardless of your race or skin color, you have broken the law, and there's punitive consequences that come with that. Where it becomes an issue is when you have a white person commit a similar crime or the same crime as a black or brown person, and they get different consequences, different time, prison time, or just, you know, a different consequence, different punishment. That's where it becomes very apparent of the white privilege, very apparent of the inferiority of the black and brown community. And what does play a role is the narratives of, you know, most black men are criminals, right? And so when they're in a court of law with the judge, whether the judge is black or not, that does work against them in the court of law. Instead of allowing them to have a fresh start and a chance at who is this guy, what is his character, you know, is this his first offense, second offense, what does that look like, what kind of mental health diversion can we provide him instead of jail time, can we give him half of the time and then give him the rest mental health diversion, what kind of you know, resources can we provide so that we can rehabilitate him, or better yet, let's create programs that prevent, so we're not always intervening and having to rehabilitate, because as much as rehabilitation sounds good, the you know, relapse rate is extremely high. So how effective is rehabilitation if the relapse rate as far as returning to prison is extremely high? That means that we need to be creating stuff that folks can get involved in that can prevent them from becoming outlaws versus waiting for them to fall short and break limbs that we cannot fix because it's too late. And that's where I am working, you know, my buns off with everything I have, attempting to create that type of environment, that type of curriculum inside as well as outside of the police department. And they have welcomed that, so I'm grateful for that, and I look forward to working with them on that, and we're creating logistics of what that will look like, while I also work with the black officers to make sure that we're finding out what they need. And then I also want to make sure that all law enforcement, regardless of what their color is, it's a human right for everyone to have a good quality of life and a healthy mental mindset, making sure that they get the treatment they need, because, again, we can't turn the finger on them only, because our people, our families, our community, we're at the hands of these people. So we got to make sure that they're healthy-minded when they are pulling us over, when they are having conversations with us. And that's what's most important. So, Judge, I am so happy to, you know, be on the call. You know, I love conversating with you anyway, because we always go so deep. We're both high-functioning intellects, and so we can go on for hours about this stuff. But that the culture competence piece is really important. And, you know, of course, I'll keep you guys updated on how everything goes moving forward with the you know, the LAPD down here and the training that's going on. And I can't wait to see the efficacy and the results that come from it. But it won't happen overnight. But, you know, I can't wait to be able to start to see that from the officer's perspective first, and for them to be able to see how the community shifts with, as they become better officers, the community really does become a better culture and better community. I really do believe that. So Valerie and Judge, I love you both, and thank you for having me on again. It's always good.
Well, Doc, you know, if and when, more likely when, I become mayor here in Memphis next year, I'm going to bring you in to do the same thing for this police department we have here. It's needed. And that is one of the intelligent solutions that I have heard. And we have to talk about it some more. By the way, I sent you a couple of texts just on some points. while you were talking. Now, we have to do something about making it cool to be rational and reasonable. We have to
okay, Judge,
make
don't,
it
Judge,
cool.
Don't kill me. It's 2:16. I got to get off and hop into a session. Okay?
I know. I thought
you want.
Aren't you 3 hours? You're 2 hours behind me, right? Okay. Oh yeah,
it's
I see.
It's 2:16 right
I
now.
I thought you were at 1:16. I said she's got an hour more to go. All right, I forget. Sorry, Doc.
No,
thank
it's okay.
You for coming on. We'll talk and read the text I sent you.
Does she want to do a Teen Mom shout out or no? Are we trying to drive?
You
want to
do that, but you have a
well,
client.
I will say this. I'll end it on this. The show has gone so well that MTV has given us a green light on season 2. And that should tell you all you need to know in the sense of tuning in every Tuesday at 8 p.m. on MTV. It's an amazing show. The moms and dads are doing, super awesome work. They're healing. They're crying. They're breaking through. They're trusting themselves. They're trusting me. They're trusting the process. And, again, we are so excited to announce that we will have a season 2, and we still have 3 more episodes to go. So everyone, tune in. Another thing that's really awesome is I am extremely honored and so humbled to say that I am the only Black woman, or just Black life coach, on TV right now, and the only, obviously, Black life coach on MTV. That's a lot for women. That's a lot for us minority women. It's a lot for us brown girls and little girls who grow up and want to just be able to heal and change life. I am grateful to be able to have opened up that door for them to hopefully, I'm hoping to make it just a little bit easier for them to get in position and really, really be able to fulfill and live out their dreams. And so that's a big deal, Judge Valerie, that, we have a Black woman life coach that's on there. We've had therapists, but as of now, I am, from what we have researched, I'm the only Black life coach on TV. And so that's rockstar. That's exciting.
Therapist and life coaches can be the same person, but they're different functions. Am I right on that?
Yes, very different.
Okay.
And I'm a hybrid.
Now.
Yes.
Are you okay? Now. Would you like to give us your social media if you're interested in people tuning in to where they can get personal messages from you or the latest announcement of what you're up to?
My website is drbryant.co. That's drbryant.co. And my Instagram is _dr_bryant. Again, that's _drbryant. And Facebook is just Dr. Cheyenne Bryant.
There you go. So enjoy your counseling session. Anyway.
Of course I will. And I'll be calling you. I'll call you later on so we can counsel each other, Judge.
All right.
Okay, please.
All right,
Doc. Love
you. Have a good day.
Bye.
Love you, too. Have a great one. Bye-bye.
You too, honey. Bye.
I hope you're enjoying this big exclusive via the Judge Show Brown Show. Don't forget to subscribe to this channel. Now, back to the show.
This show is sponsored by the Hurricane Reports, merchandise, and more.